thank you for coming today. I have an onerous task giving your first colloquium of the year. I guess technically I am from New Jersey. I've spent more than half my life in New Jersey, and I have a very typical New Jersey accent, as you can tell. So today I'm going to tell you about quantum phase transitions. But before I do so, and here is the first slide, I wanted to really motivate some of my reasons for working in condensed matter physics, in fact, for working in physics at all. And so this first slide here, in some sense, captures how I'm excited about physics. So perhaps as a youngster, you grow up learning that the frontiers of physics are the very small and the very large, and they certainly are. But at the same time, you learn that actually the physics right under your nose, the physics in your lab, in your cryostat, actually teaches you an immense amount about the world at large. And in fact, there is a certain connection between the two. What we learn in the lab teaches us principles that tell us about the cosmos, and this was true in Isaac Newton's time with the apocryphal story of the apple, which taught him about the orbits of the solar system. But it was also true in the last century, where the understanding of the Meissner effect in superconductors led truly to an understanding of how gauge bosons acquire a mass, which of course is at the heart of understanding the forces and in fact the mass of particles in the universe. And so there has always been this tension and interplay between physics in the lab and physics in the universe at large, and that goes on today. But there are those times when you wonder, well, did I miss it all? Because after all the great things occurred 50 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, and now it's the grunge work, is it? And so in thinking about this, I always need to have historical stories to keep me going. And I don't really know, but it is my contention that we are not at the end of the quantum revolution, but we are actually, in fact, probably right in the middle of it, and we just don't realize it. And so how can I prove this to you? I can't, although I will tell you today about something we really don't understand about the quantum mechanical behavior of many body systems. But I will tell you a story about classical mechanics. We all learn that classical mechanics is a rigorous, systematic, closed piece of art in our understanding of the world. And yet, actually, it took a very long time for classical mechanics to develop, and I want to tell you that story just for the moment. But I will be coming back and talking about phase transitions in the quantum era. Okay, and this is a very brief outline of what I'll be talking about. And for the moment, we're going to talk about the quantum era from classical to quantum. And then we'll be talking about classical criticality before I turn to talk about an area of active research which is teaching us about what we don't know about quantum criticality. Okay. So I want to take you back to 1758 in Paris. And 1758 in Paris was an important year because it was the first arrival of Halley's comet after Halley first saw it. Okay? And it filled the night sky in Paris. And it caused them to bring out a new publication, which they'd had on their books for 10 years. And in fact, what this illustrates is that even though we're actually 72 years after Principia, the classical revolution was still very much in sway. And ideas which we now consider to be sacred were very much under contention. So the publishers in Paris decide to bring out the first French translation of Newton's Principia, which they've held in proof form for 10 years. Okay? And here it is, Principe mathématique de la philosophie naturelle, and the author is Madame la Marquise du Châtelet. Do you see Newton here? Nowhere. It's interesting, this is really more a rev mod phys of the time than actually a direct translation of Newton's work. And here is the author of this work, She is the Marquise Emily du Châtelet. She was a string theorist of her era. She was educated in Leibnizian calculus by the best members of the French Academy. She was what we would call a mathematical physicist. She was also very wealthy. She was married, and in the tradition of the time, just because you're married after you have your kids, life went on, and she had many partners. And one of her partners, for a long time, was Voltaire, in fact. And she influenced him greatly, and they did many physics experiments together in her castle. Okay? No, it's true. And so, this is a quote of hers, "Ce beau problème astronomico-géométrique." And what she did was to survey the Leibnizian and the Newtonian view of mechanics, and they were conflicting. Now you might say, why were they conflicting? It wasn't just because Newton had stolen the claim to having invented calculus, but it was actually that they disagreed on the physics. Newton had proposed the conservation of momentum, and Leibniz agreed with him. But Leibniz had introduced another concept, which he called the life force, la vie vivre, of matter. And he had a formula for it, which was a sum over mv squared. Okay? And there's no mistake here. There was no half in the formula. And Newton thought that this was rubbish. It was wrong. He knew, because experiments showed that the sum over mv squared is certainly not a conserved quantity. And in fact, this controversy and the missing factor of Hearth required a further 60 to 80 years for its resolution. In fact, the fellow who put the factor of one half in was Coriolis. And it wasn't until the discovery of heat and the idea of heat that you could actually solve the problem of where the missing kinetic energy goes to, and that was the origin of the controversy. So it needed a new concept, in fact, something involving the complex collective behavior of matter to finally wrap up classical mechanics, and it led to the introduction of the concept of energy, which is actually dating to about 1850. Okay. So today, 100 years after Planck, many surprises later, the quantum era is probably in full sway. And there have been many surprises along the way. Here is one of them. This is Wolfgang Pauli, who had discovered empirically the exclusion principle, which applies to atoms. And it was to his astonishment that he learned that the exclusion principle didn't just apply to atoms, but actually applied to metals, to electrons flowing in the bulk. And at the time, everyone believed that metallic behavior was associated with probably with bosonic electrons. And in fact, it's one of the dying tragedies of the field of condensed matter physics that Einstein was one of those people, because we'd have been able to call it something different to a fermion today, and we could have used the E words in our talks, which we cannot do. So in fact, with a heavy heart, I've been converted to the idea that Fermi-Dirac, not Einstein-Bose, is the correct statistics, and I wish to write a short note on its application to paramagnetism. It's in 1926. So moving a little bit closer to home, here is David Pines. I like that last little bit, dead or alive. So That's really by way of an introduction. And what I'm really going to be talking about today is trying to understand quantum zero-point fluctuations. These are the little jigglings of quantum matter produced by the uncertainty principle. And whatever you do, if you've got some quantity in a material that is not a constant of the motion, does not commute with the Hamiltonian, then that quantity necessarily undergoes these little jigglings. And that's true today. And it turns out that these jigglings are important to us not just inside quantum matter, but actually inside the quantum vacuum. And in fact, you may like to know, it's really a major unsolved problem in two respects. First of all, in the context of the vacuum we live in, 73%, or roughly that, of the mass of the cosmos that pervades this room is dark energy. And many people believe it's an unidentified form of zero-point energy. Whatever it is, it causes the expansion of the universe to accelerate. And this is a completely open question. But its counterpart inside the lab is actually zero-point fluctuations in matter. When they become intense, they profoundly transform its properties, and they endow it with a marked tendency to develop new forms of order, and they also significantly alter the properties of the underlying metal in ways that we're only beginning to understand. And that's what I'm really going to spend the remainder of the talk talking about. Okay? Okay. All right. So I'm going to talk about quantum criticality. And to do that, I want to tell you about classical criticality. What is classical criticality? It's a property of a classical phase transition. Here's a diagram we'll be coming back to later. This material has a low temperature antiferromagnetic phase transition in which the spins of the electrons develop a staggered formation, as illustrated here. And if you cool this system down from the orange into the blue region, you have a classical critical point. And what is a classical critical point? Well, in fact, here's another classical critical point. This is oxygen tuned to its critical point. Turns out that this data with the lambda transition of oxygen at its critical point was immensely important in the history of system mechanics, because it was this thing that convinced the community that they didn't understand classical second order phase transitions. The same thing had been seen in the transition to superfluid helium-4, but people thought that might be a quantum phenomenon. Seeing it here in good old oxygen convinced everyone that they had a really serious problem. And it was the beginning of a great revolution which took place in the 70s. And Michael Fisher has a great quote on this. He was one of the people at the early days of this classical revolution. And his quote is that new insights into physics often come from revisiting areas once thought to be closed. And this is often true. Here are many of the great contributors to the era of classical criticality: Leo Kadanoff, Ben Widom, Anatoly Larkin, and Ken Wilson. And what did they do? Well, in this 20th century revolution, they came up with the idea that actually when you approach a classical critical point, matter, in developing an order parameter, has a characteristic correlation length. And on scales, and that correlation length diverges as you come into this critical point. And on scales less than that correlation length, it turns out that the behavior of the thermal fluctuations of the order parameter are completely universal. And they're controlled by power law correlations, which have unusual exponents. And those exponents don't depend on the microscopic physics at all. So if you take an Ising ferromagnet, measure its exponents, and you take water at its critical point, you measure exactly the same critical exponent in the correlations. Okay? So this universal behavior is a property of phase transitions governed by thermal fluctuations. Okay? So what's a quantum phase transition? It's a phase transition which if it's second order, is driven by zero-point motion. And here's an example. In this case, the order parameter is the difference between the even and the odd side spins. And that order parameter doesn't commute with the Hamiltonian, unlike a ferromagnetic order parameter. And so it naturally undergoes fluctuations, which in an antiferromagnet are small enough that the long range order is preserved, at least in dimensions 2 and higher. Okay? In one dimension, those fluctuations are so strong that you don't get one-dimensional Heisenberg antiferromagnets. But in higher dimensions, you can tune the fluctuations. And in this material, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon 2, you can tune those fluctuations and drive it through this point here, which is a quantum critical point, that very point there. And there it is. And it raises the question, well, what happens in a quantum critical point? Presumably now we have to think about not only the length scales of correlation, but also the time scales. What happens when these diverge? Presumably one will develop perhaps quantum critical matter, a state of matter, perhaps with universal properties, that maybe forget about the microscopic details of the atoms and electrons that give rise to them. And so what this colloquium is really about is the efforts that are underway to try to understand quantum critical matter. Now, to tell you about this, I have to take you back over some history, because it turns out that the unusual effects that are being observed are typically in certain kinds of metals that are very much close to an antiferromagnetic phase transition, such as ytterbium, rhodium, silicon 2. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about these metals before I tell you what's so extraordinary about them and how they lead us to believe that the electron is in some sense actually breaking up at this quantum critical point. These color codes we'll come back to shortly. Okay. So here are some systems which perhaps motivate quantum critical behavior. This example of a cuprate superconductor. Another one is a heavy electron superconductor. And here's an iron-based superconductor. And these materials are fascinating to us because we'd like to understand the glue or the fabric of the underlying superconductor. What kind of electronic fluid leads to high-temperature superconductivity? High-temperature superconductor, here's one that has a 40 Kelvin transition temperature. And it has a very fascinating linear resistivity that goes all the way up to the point where it actually melts. This is an enduring an unsolved problem of condensed matter physics, which many believe is connected with a hidden quantum critical point. Why is that? Well, this is the idea. It's believed that underneath the dome in the phase diagram of superconductivity, this is the temperature versus doping, this is the superconducting region, is a hidden quantum critical point that transforms the nature of the metal up here. Okay? And this has been dubbed avoided criticality. Unfortunately, when you've got 90 Kelvin transition temperatures, you need hundreds of Tesla to remove the superconductivity. And so it turns out this quantum critical point is very hard to actually see and remains a point of contention as to whether there really is a quantum critical point and what is the order that's producing it. But it's certainly a great motivator for studying quantum critical points. Okay. Here is another system where we can look at the quantum critical point. This is cerium, rhodium, indium 5. It's a very fragile antiferromagnet. And this is temperature in Kelvin, 5 Kelvin. It's got a 4 Kelvin transition. And if you put on 3 gigapascals of pressure, you can drive the transition temperature down to zero. And once it hits zero, you form a superconductor in that region there. And you can actually apply a field to this fragile superconductor and see quantum critical behavior outside the critical dome. And so here is an example of real avoided criticality, and this system also has very strange metallic properties. Okay. So now I want to go back and tell you about the standard view of condensed matter metallic systems. This really goes back to an idea of Lev Landau. And he was very concerned about the properties of metals which have strong Coulomb interactions between the atoms, between the electrons. And he came up with the idea that maybe to understand them, you have to think about turning on the interactions adiabatically, very slowly. It's a typical theorist idea. If you can't get rid of the interactions, imagine they're small. If you can solve the case of very small interactions, well, what would happen if you gradually increase them adiabatically? Well, Landau came up with the idea that if you did this to a system of free electrons and you turn them on adiabatically, or a system of free fermions, that what would happen is that the excitations of the non-interacting quantum fluid would evolve adiabatically into something he called a quasi-particle. Quasi-particle carries the same quantum numbers as the original electron. And he proposed this originally not for an electronic fluid, but actually for another fermionic fluid, liquid helium-3. And he deduced that if you knew a few parameters that parameterize the interactions of these quasiparticles, you could actually deduce various important properties of this quasiparticle, in particular, the renormalization of the quasiparticle mass. And around this time, 1957, it turned out you could actually begin to measure the specific heat capacity of helium-3. And from the gradient, the linear specific heat, you could actually pull out the fact that m star over m is 2.8. So when helium atoms move around in liquid helium-3, they actually do so with an enhanced mass of about 3 times the helium mass. Here is Landau in 1956. And let me introduce you to some of the characters in this picture. This is Lev Landau. This is Freeman Dyson. Here is Anatoly Larkin, who went on to solve the problem of classical criticality. And here is Alexei Abrikosov, who recently received the Nobel Prize for the theory of flux lattices. Okay? And this guy here is a guy called Pomeranchuk, actually. Okay? And so, in fact, there is an interesting question here. So adiabaticity works, but how far can you go? What happens when that interaction gets too large? Okay? And this question has been one of the central questions of condensed matter physics over the years. And so here is our axis. We turn up the interaction labeled by U, and think of it as a ratio with the bandwidth labeled by T. And so what happens when the interaction becomes too large? Landau had an answer to this, and it was that electrons order. They'll order into some kind of ordered state at some critical value of the interaction strength, such as ferromagnetism, for example, which occurs at a critical interaction strength, okay? Or charge density wave, or spin density wave, okay? Or other exotic order parameters. So another idea was brought forward by Sir Neville Mott in 1947, and his opinion on this was if you make the interactions too large, then the electrons will not be able to move around. They can't occupy the same atom as they move around, and therefore they'll localize. Okay? Another idea was proposed by Phil Anderson in 1961 with the discovery of localized magnetic moments, and he proposed, in fact it was based on experiment, that localized magnetic moments condense inside a metal when the interactions become too large. But the story begins, really, with something due to a fellow called John Hertz, who in 1976 said, hey, but let's not worry about what happens to the electrons beyond this point. Let's talk about the point itself. Because that point, he argued, would actually be a quantum critical point and would lead to long-range interactions between the electrons that would mean that the Landau theory itself perhaps wouldn't be relevant. His ideas were ahead of their time. At the time, everyone was coping with classical criticality, and the paper, as so many great papers do, was hardly referenced for the first 10 or 15 years of its life. So, now another digression. To explain these materials I'm going to talk about, I have to talk about an effect called the Kondo effect. Now, one of the things you discover when you're a graduate student is you're bombarded with new terms. There's always those code words that occur in the research discussion that send you off track. And Kondo effect is a word that comes along a lot in this field. So I should tell you about it because it's very important. And of course, the first thing you do if you want to understand what an effect is today is that you go to Google. So here's what happens when you Google Kondo. Here he is. Okay. He's great. This is the KHR2HB. This is the robot that plays soccer, fights with other bots, and this is a sign of the new world we live in. He dances salsa. Okay? I'd love to have one of those. But actually, in the scientific world, Kondo means something else. It's actually A 75-year-old odyssey of discovery. In the early 30s, physicists discovered that when they look at metals such as gold at low temperatures, the resistivity doesn't go down forever, it actually bottoms out and comes back up. Okay? And this wasn't understood in 1936, it wasn't even understood in 1956. It wasn't really understood in detail until the 1970s. Okay? And it turns out that this behavior is produced by the presence of localized magnetic moments. In the case of gold, iron impurities that are sitting inside the gold. And the fellow who first resolved this this issue was Jun Kondo, who wrote down this very, very simple model in 1962. Let me just tell you what this means. This is a Hamiltonian. This is the energy of the free electrons buzzing around this local moment. And this is the local moment, the spin, interacting with the spin density at the site of that moment. And there's just one free parameter here, J. And what Kondo did was to calculate the resistivity to third order in J, and discovered, when he did third order perturbation theory, that the scattering got stronger and stronger as he went to lower temperatures, explaining this minimum. But actually it became so strong that once you got below this temperature scale, now called the Kondo temperature, you could no longer use perturbation theory. In fact, this was another one of those discoveries that has its counterpart in field theory and particle physics. This is a discovery of confinement. A free moment at high temperatures becomes antiferromagnetically screened at low temperatures via a mechanism which is the same as quark confinement. So at high temperatures, the spins are asymptotically free. But at low temperatures, what happens is that, in some sense, this local moment becomes screened and behaves just as a charge. And what happens to the spin it had is it becomes delocalized into the surrounding sea to form a kind of resonance. And this resonance actually has properties which are nothing more than Landau's Fermi liquid at the lowest possible temperatures. So when you put local magnetic moments like this into a conduction sea, they kind of quantum mechanically dissolve to form a heavy electron that sits around that site. Okay? And the susceptibility crosses over from being a Curie susceptibility to a Pauli susceptibility. Okay? So that's the story here, but it turns out that in fact, when you have dense arrays of atoms that interact strongly with their surroundings, such as this material, uranium-beryllium-13, a similar effect occurs. And remarkably, if you look at their behavior, for example, let's look at their resistivity, you see this same Kondo resistance minimum up here and the rising resistivity. But as you cool down, they reach a maximum because the scattering off each site becomes coherent and they form coherent heavy electron metals at low temperatures. The resistivity plummets, and this heavy Fermi liquid is nothing more than another realization of Landau's Fermi liquid. The masses of the particles in these Fermi liquids are not just 1, 2, or 3 times the electron mass, but can rise to as much as 1,000 times the electron mass. In fact, there are experiments going on in this lab, Steve Julian's lab in particular, which are measuring the mass and the properties of those heavy electrons. Okay. One of the interesting things about them, however, is that these systems lie at the very brink of instability into magnetism. Just takes a little kick, and you can make those moments reappear. And when they do, the question is, what happens to the Fermi liquid? Okay? This brings us to the topic of heavy electron quantum criticality. Okay. So let's talk about experiments that people have done. And here's a classic experiment carried out in the 1990s, in which the nail temperature of cerium-indium-3 was suppressed down to zero, and it gave rise to a superconductor with a tiny transition temperature of 0.2 Kelvin. Later on, physicists discovered that if you made layered versions of these things, you could do the same thing, but now push the transition temperature all the way up to 2 Kelvin. It's another example, cerium cobalt indium 5, in this case tuned with cadmium, chemical pressure, and you can drive it from the superconductor back into the antiferromagnet. And in fact, this family of superconductors is not done. Even today, people are interested in intermetallic superconductors. TC has jumped at least another factor of 10 since these days. Here is one interesting and very early important piece of data on a system where you can reveal the quantum critical point. This is cerium copper 6 doped with gold. Now, when you see something like this, it's very useful as a theorist to take to separate yourself from the detailed chemistry. So cerium copper 6 gold looks horrifically complicated, and if you saw the crystal structure of this, it's like a nightmare. It's a very complex crystal structure, monoclinic. However, to a first approximation, let's face it, it's just copper, right, with a bit of cerium in it. Okay. So the only difference is that the mass of electrons, when you put a bit of cerium into this stuff, is 1,000 times that of copper. Okay. So these heavy electrons coming from the cerium orbitals are already very fragile electrons, close to that instability. And now if you dope in some gold, you can expand the lattice just that little bit more. And what happens as you do that is the antiferromagnetism comes on, the antiferromagnetism develops. And you can see the C over T ratio, the linear specific heat, rising and becoming logarithmic at this critical doping. And then it becomes an antiferromagnet. And so the fact that C over T has this logarithmic behavior is very interesting. It means that you're not settling into a Fermi liquid. There's no real scale to the problem here. Or put another way, if C over T diverges, albeit very slowly at low temperatures, doesn't this mean that the mass of the electrons is actually no longer finite? It's gone off to infinity. Put another way, the Fermi temperature has collapsed down to zero. This is a very strange situation. Normally, the Fermi temperature in a metal is out at 10,000 Kelvin. Who cares about physics above the Fermi temperature? That's chemistry. But in these systems, you can tune the Fermi temperature down to millikelvin, in fact, shrink it to zero. How do you know it's gone to zero? You don't. You can't ever go down to absolute zero, but you can see it going there, and you can ask the question, if I go slower, is it getting slower? And the answer is yes. And so then you're raising the question, well, if T Fermi becomes very, very small, what's happening when I warm up above T Fermi? Okay. Here's another example. Here's this system we came to originally. Ytterbium rhodium 2 silicon 2 has a resistivity, and you can look at the exponent of the resistivity, and it's color-coded here. When it's blue, it's quadratic. And one of the properties of the Landau Fermi liquid is that the phase space for scattering and creating a particle hole excitation grows quadratically with energy. And that leads to a resistivity that grows quadratically with temperature. And so here you see a nice Landau Fermi liquid, but notice that when you hit the critical field, that resistivity now becomes linear. So it's that same linear resistance seen in the cuprate superconductors. Here it is again as a function of field. And you can actually measure this A coefficient of the T squared and find it diverges as you come in towards the critical point. And this divergence is another signature that the Fermi temperature is collapsing towards zero, in this case as the square root of the field difference from B critical. So one of the ideas that you might try here is to say, well, look, you know, maybe electrons are localizing at this quantum critical point. Okay. And there are reasons to believe that this is the case. So how could you tell if they were? And so one idea that was proposed about 8 years ago was that if the electrons actually localize at a quantum critical point, if these emergent heavy fermions now become localized moments, then wouldn't you expect an abrupt evolution in the Fermi surface? And so this was suggested around 2001. The counter idea would be that you develop a density wave in the magnetization. And if that were to occur, there are reasons to suppose that the Fermi surface would evolve continuously. And so you could look at the Hall constant, which measures the density of electrons, and you might expect it to jump if the electrons were somehow localizing at the quantum critical point. Okay. So this idea was then explored by experimentalists, and it turns out that you can actually see the Hall constant evolving rapidly as you go through a quantum critical point, and that evolution becomes sharper and sharper as you go to lower temperatures. In fact, today we know that this evolution here, the gradual evolution, actually scales with the temperature, and this becomes sharper and sharper as you go to lower and lower temperatures. Another indication of this same phenomenon is actually seen in a number of other properties. Turns out in this same system, ytterbium, rhodium, silicon 2, you can actually follow the line where the Hall constant evolves rapidly and starts to jump in many other properties, in the magnetization, in some of the lattice expansion properties. And it seems like there's a scale here associated with the change in the size of the Fermi surface, which collapses down towards this quantum critical point. Another indication of this collapse in the Fermi surface reconstruction comes from measurements on this system at cerium, rhodium, indium 5. And in this system, you can actually do de Haas van Alphen measurements, and you can follow the orbits of the electrons as you go from the antiferromagnet into the metal. And as you do so, you find two interesting things. First, the masses diverge, but also the orbits areas actually jump at this point. And so that's rather odd, because it means that you're going from a small to a large Fermi surface. Like so. But it's not a first order phase transition, because we know this is actually a second order phase transition. So how can that jump occur? Well, perhaps it's because the electrons at the Fermi surface are becoming increasingly fragile. They are much less, the overlap with a regular electron, this adiabatic overlap of Landau's, is actually going to zero at this quantum critical point. So now I want to come to an idea that actually seems to be coming more relevant with time as time goes on, and is part of the motivation for the picture that went with this this colloquium. And that's the idea that actually a quantum critical point is actually a singularity in the phase diagram. If it's a singularity in the phase diagram, in fact, in a more prosaic language, it's almost like a black hole in the fabric of the material phase diagram. Why do we believe this? Let me tell you why this is the case. And to do this, I want to take you back and tell you about an idea that Feynman had many years before the advent of quantum criticality. Feynman realized that you can reformulate quantum mechanics in terms of histories of trajectories. And if you want to calculate the amplitude for a process, you have to sum over all possible histories. And the same is true if you want to calculate the partition function of quantum system mechanics. You have to sum over all histories of the evolution of the particle trajectories. But you have to do that in a very weird way. You have to introduce a time variable that is actually not real, but imaginary. And the reason for that is that the Boltzmann distribution function is like the Schrödinger evolution, or the Heisenberg evolution, in imaginary time. So the idea is that you have to understand the behavior of your field or the trajectory of your electrons in time. And when you introduce a temperature, what the temperature does is actually provides a boundary condition in time. So actually, finite temperature quantum mechanics is like quantum mechanics in a four-dimensional world, but in which the time direction actually has periodic or anti-periodic boundary conditions. So time is like a boundary condition. Now, how is that useful for us in understanding the difference between a classical and a quantum phase transition? Well, let's look at that. So let's go and look at the phase diagram we have here. And let's imagine what happens as we cool down. So if we're in this region here, presumably, as we come closer and closer to this quantum critical point, we're going to have a bubble of quantum critical matter, whatever that stuff is, labeled by a finite correlation length and a finite correlation time. Let's supposing, as we cool down here, that that quantity becomes constant, but as we come in towards the critical point, those two scales actually diverge, right? So let's look at the situation. If we're looking at physics inside the quantum critical bubble or at a point at finite temperature here, then we've got a finite temperature, and that means we're probing the physics, quantum physics, on a finite time scale. If that time scale is shorter than the correlation time at absolute zero, in that case, you're going to be looking at the physics inside the quantum critical bubble. If you now cool down below to the point where this scale 1 over t becomes larger than psi t, what situation are you going to have? Well, it's going to look like this. Now 1 over t is much larger, and now your quantum critical bubble is actually smaller than your boundary conditions. You can now probe outside the quantum critical bubble. And that's what you're doing when you go through this crossover from this region of strange, almost linear resistivity into the region of the T-squared resistivity, the Fermi liquid. You're looking outside the quantum critical bubble, and when you do that, you find it's a Fermi liquid. So on long length scales and long times, this is a Fermi liquid, but on short time scales and short lengths, it's quantum critical. And as we get closer and closer in, this length scale and time scale gets larger and larger, and we have to go to lower and lower temperatures to see the Fermi liquid. Okay? So here's another way of thinking about it. And notice something interesting here. At a classical phase transition, temperature tunes you through the transition, takes you this way. But at a quantum transition, temperature does something completely different. It changes your boundary conditions. It probes the length scale you're looking at, the physics, the time scale. So if we go through like this from the Fermi liquid at a finite temperature into the anti-ferromagnetic metal, in some sense, this is what we're doing. We're taking a journey from the heavy fermion metal, and we're crossing through this crossover here, and we're probing the physics inside the quantum critical bubble. So we're really crossing through a kind of event horizon, because the physics inside that horizon has no resemblance, no memory of the microscopic physics that gave rise to it. And if we continue outside, continue on out into this side here, we are now going out into the anti-ferromagnet, into another universe of condensed matter physics. And so the quantum critical point for us is the point that separates our different universes of stable behavior. We get to tune our materials. We get to go from one type of behavior to another. And as we do so, we create new universes for collective behavior. And what the quantum critical point, it's a pathway, it's a portal that takes us from one type, one universal class of behavior to another. We want to understand that portal. Okay. And as the illustration shows here, there's a suspicion that the concept of an electron no longer applies to the Fermi, to this fluid in the vicinity of this quantum critical point. One last point about this. What this also means is that the quantum critical point influences a huge swath of the material phase diagram. Provided you're at a temperature where you're looking inside the quantum critical bubble, you're going to get the strange metal behavior, and we'd like to understand the behavior of this strange metal. Okay, so. Okay, so here's some data. I'm going to tell you about some data that tells us something very weird is going on here. This is data first taken in the mid-90s by Megan Aronson and co-workers, neutron scattering on this powder material, and they found that at the quantum critical point that you could look at the magnetic fluctuations and find that you could take data at different temperatures and collapse them onto a single diagram where omega over T, or energy divided by temperature, was the only variable, suggesting this kind of collapse of the data. Here's more recent data taken on cerium, copper, 6 gold. This is single crystal, and again, the magnetic fluctuations can be collapsed into this kind of scaling plot, and the horizontal axis here is E over T again. And the point is that if temperature is the only scale in the emerging magnetic correlations, it means E over T can also be written as E times tau, where tau is 1 over T. And so, indeed, 1 over T is behaving as a characteristic time scale in this problem. And if you like, this is proof of the idea, Feynman's idea, that temperature is a boundary condition in time. However, this is very mysterious behavior for reasons that I'll come to in a moment. In its classical counterpart, this kind of behavior is very well known. If you introduce a boundary condition on a classical critical system, it develops a finite correlation length determined by that boundary condition. So this seems completely okay, excepting that it turns out that this kind of behavior is quite different to what our microscopic theories of quantum critical points in metals predict, and I'll tell you why. Okay? In particular, this means that the physics is below what's called the upper critical dimension of the critical point. And here's the problem. Ken, what time do we stop?
5, 10 minutes.
Okay, great. This is the standard model of antiferromagnetism or magnetism in a metal. And it's a model with a great parentage. It goes back to work by Doniak, Schrieffer, Hertz, Millis, Maria in the 60s. The idea is very simple, that if you want to understand a magnetic instability, you think of a Fermi surface of electrons, and you treat it as electrons interacting through soft fluctuations of the order parameter. And you can describe those soft fluctuations in a fashion very similar to classical fluctuations of an order parameter. You have a correlation length, and you have a dependence on the Q vector of this dynamical susceptibility. And this part of the equation was first proposed back in the early part of the 19th century for classical phase conditions by Ornstein and Zanicki in Holland. This part here comes from the presence of the Fermi surface, because these fluctuations are damped, and the damping goes linearly with the energy in a Fermi liquid. Okay? Now this is kind of interesting, because if you look at correlation function here, inverse correlation function, you can see that energy and momentum come in with different powers. And this is one of those things that's different between relativistic systems and non-relativistic systems. In this system, the fluctuations aren't, in some sense, relativistic, because time and space count differently. One unit of energy counts like 2 units of momentum. One unit of time counts like 2 units of space. And when you carefully analyze the critical behavior of this system, it turns out that you have to add one extra time dimension, which now counts as 2 extra space dimensions in the analysis. So time counts as 2 scaling dimensions. And this quantity here is called Z. It's called the dynamical critical exponent. And it means that if your dimensionality in space is 3, your dimensionality in scaling theory is actually 3 plus 2, which is 5. Now, it turns out that in these kinds of models, 4 is the upper critical dimension. Below 4 dimensions, you expect scaling behavior. You expect boundary effects to come in as the only influence on the problem. But above 4 dimensions, in 5 dimensions, it turns out that temperature should not act as the only effect, the only boundary condition effect. And so this E over T scaling observed in experiments is not expected on the basis of this standard model of quantum criticality. And so this is one of many reasons why we don't believe this standard model actually works for us in these particular systems. There are cases where perhaps it appears to work. You might try to argue that if you drop the dimensionality down to 2, 2 plus 2 is 4, you're at the marginal dimension. And there are elements of quasi-two-dimensionality sometimes in these systems, but the observation of an unusual exponent tells us that we're below the upper critical dimension, and so this is a mystery. So in the last few moments, I'll tell you a bit about some of the new ideas that are around. I probably won't get to the whole story, and I'll probably skip to the conclusions before I get to the end. But one of the ideas is that the electron actually, if the Fermi temperature is going to 0, then the stuff you have above the Fermi temperature must describe excitations, incoherent excitations that do not describe, are not described by an electron or a Landau quasiparticle. This is the kind of model we'd love to solve. It's called the Kondo lattice model. It actually was first written down in a thesis in 1951, 58 years ago. And even today, we don't have very good methods for understanding its properties. We can't solve this problem numerically, for example. But schematically, the problem that we're facing, and the takeaway picture, perhaps, is the fact that we don't understand the zero modes that separate the region where the spins are condensed to the region where the spins are bound to charges to form composite fermions. We don't understand this point here where the spins become deconfined as they go from here to here. Here they're confined, here they are in a state of long-range order. And what the data suggests is that this is a fundamentally new kind of zero mode. We believe there may be some universality here. If we understood the universal physics of this quantum critical point, perhaps we'd actually arrive at a Lagrangian or a Hamiltonian that actually is useful outside the lab. Okay. So why is this so difficult for the theorist? Experimentalists have revealed some fascinating properties. Why is this so difficult? One of the problems is that when you have strong interactions, the Hilbert space of your underlying electron fluid is split up. So, for example, if you form a local moment, it's just a spin. The charge degrees of freedom have been sent off to infinity, and it turns out that the elimination of those states from the Hilbert space means that you have to put them, the elimination in as a kind of constraint. Once you have constraints, it turns out that means you have to introduce fields that impose the constraints. And those fields have the character of gauge theories. And so strongly correlated problems very quickly take you into the domain of gauge theories in particle physics. One example, if you take Schringer's method of writing down a magnetic moment in terms of bosons, Schringer bosons, it turns out that this has a U1 symmetry because you can change the phase of the boson. Anyway, so this means there's no small parameter in our calculations, and we have to find ways of controlling the calculations. For example, one approach that's extremely interesting to the community is the use of so-called large N theories, in which you take the number of spin components to be very, very large. Okay, let me tell you a few ideas. One idea that's been explored by Chi-Miao Si and Kevin Ingerson down in Houston and Florida is the idea that maybe the critical degrees of freedom in these systems are local, that there's a kind of local quantum criticality. And in fact, one indication this is the case is from experiment in which the critical behavior, the dependence of the critical fluctuations on energy, has a power law which doesn't seem to depend on the position and momentum space. So these guys have proposed the idea that the critical spin fluctuations are local in space but critical in time. And when they went through their calculations, they could explain some aspects of the physics, but it required a two-dimensional spin fluid, not a three-dimensional one, as that is actually observed. Other ideas have been proposed by folks working on frustrated magnetism. And one of the ideas that has come out is the idea that actually the fluid in which the critical matter develops is actually a fluid in which the electrons are broken up into free spins and free charges, spin-ons in the language of the game, and then at some longer length scale, those spin-ons would recombine to form regular electrons or spins. There would then be two correlation lengths. Another idea that's been explored is the search for a new kind of mean field theory around which one could expand the physics, and various people have been involved in this, in particular Catherine Pepin at Saclay in Paris. Okay, I'm just going to show a few quick pictures here which I'm going to skip over. One of the ideas that people have been worried about is bringing back magnetism, and in magnetism you can destroy magnetism by increasing fluctuations, quantum fluctuations. And there's interest in trying to unify our understanding of fluctuations in magnetism with the idea of the Kondo effect destroying antiferromagnetism. And just to show you there are some recent experimental results in Germany in which it's been possible to actually tune the quantum critical point into a regime where it looks like the point where the electrons localize is actually separated from the Nail transition. And this might be possible if the passage from antiferromagnetism to the heavy fermi liquid passes through an intermediate spin liquid. I'm going to skip over these pictures, however, because time is short, and go to the conclusions. There are, in fact, a number of materials which seem to show that the quantum critical point where the electrons display unusual behavior may actually open up into an unusual phase. I'm going to skip over this. Time is short. And just mention some new developments that are going on right now, which bring in the idea of the black hole. It turns out that, in fact, this joke about the black hole actually has some additional significance, because it turns out that there is a way of mapping lower dimensional field theories onto higher dimensional gravity theories. And it's a rather amusing thing that when you want to introduce temperature into these higher dimensional gravity theories, what you have to do is to add a black hole. So it's rather amusing that what was once considered in jest has actually come out as a new idea, and there are various particle physicists at the moment who are still waiting for the Large Hadron Collider to be activated, who are actually thinking about the use of these so-called ADS-CFT ideas to try to understand non-Fermi liquid physics. This is part of a very serious program going on at the moment. There's also new ideas from Finn Anderson talking about the possibility of something called a hidden Fermi liquid. We've been interested in the possibility of this unusual spin liquid, and a central at MIT has proposed the idea of critical Fermi surfaces, and all of these emerging ideas have in common the idea of a critical Fermi surface with branch cuts replacing poles in the excitation spectrum. So I'm going to conclude. These are a whole bunch of collaborators who I've been involved in particular my graduate student Rebecca Flint, postdocs Maxime DeZero, and Andre Nevedomsky, Jerome Rech, who has now moved to Marseille in the CNRS, and a whole bunch of physicists, experimentalists, and theorists who've all influenced the ideas in this talk. And I'm just going to put these conclusions up just to be up there. Thank you.